Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, John Little, Sullivan County's Health and Human Services Commissioner, joins us to discuss the federal the issue with SNAP payments. Without federal action, as many as 6,000 county households could miss their November payments, a gap that may strain families, food pantries, and the local economy. Catskill Mountain Keeper is celebrating what it calls a first step toward victory after the state paused the Route 17 expansion project. The DOT says it's reassessing its plans following community pushback, and environmental groups want Governor Hochul to take the highway widening off the table for good. Plus, culture reporter Valerie Manzi visits Bushel Collective in Delhi, and local economic perspective from our own James B. Huntington. First, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Health officials in Gaza say Israeli airstrikes yesterday killed nearly 50 people in the enclave. NPR's Aya Batraoui reports the attacks threatened to unravel a U.S.-brokered ceasefire.
Israel's military says two soldiers were killed in an attack in southern Gaza, sparking a wave of airstrikes that killed Palestinians, many of them women and children, over the weekend. Israel says it also dropped more than 120 bombs on a Hamas tunnel. A Hamas official who spoke anonymously to NPR in order to brief the media says it was rogue militants who carried out the deadly attack on Israeli troops. President Trump also told reporters that, quote, rebels were behind the attack. Meanwhile, White House envoy Steve Witkoff and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner are visiting Israel to discuss next steps of the ceasefire. A senior Hamas delegation is also visiting Egypt for similar discussions. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
This is day 20 of the federal government shutdown. Republicans and Democrats are not in any significant talks to bring it to an end. Meanwhile, the Defense Department has shifted money to pay U.S. troops, but most federal workers won't get paychecks, and some, like air traffic controllers, must stay on the job. Trump administration officials say the U.S. military again destroyed a boat in the Caribbean Sea last week, killing three people. President Trump says he is attacking drug smugglers, but he has never provided evidence for this. Virginia Democratic Senator Tim Kaine says he has introduced a resolution to limit the president's military powers without congressional oversight. And he says the Trump administration has not explained why it's destroying boats in the Caribbean and killing everyone on board.
Give us your legal rationale for striking them. And then, really importantly, tell us why you struck rather than interdicted. Because if you interdict, you seize evidence. You get people. You squeeze them and they rat out the higher ups. And then you use that to build criminal prosecution. If you sink a boat to the bottom of the ocean, you don't get the evidence. They have not answered any of those questions to our satisfaction.
He spoke to NPR's Weekend All Things Considered. Stocks opened higher this morning as gas prices fell. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 200 points in early trading.
The average price of gasoline's closing in on the $3 mark for the first time in 4 years. AAA says the average price nationwide is now under $3.04 a gallon. It's dropped about a nickel in the last week. President Trump told Fox News over the weekend he does plan to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping at an upcoming summit in South Korea. Trump had earlier suggested that trade tensions could scuttle that meeting. China says its economy grew at an annual rate of 4.8% in the most recent quarter. The world's second largest economy was boosted by strong exports to markets other than the United States. Asian stocks were higher overnight, including Japan's Nikkei average, which climbed to a new record. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR News. Amazon's cloud computing system had a disruption overnight affecting companies from Roblox to United Airlines. Amazon says it is addressing the issue. Amazon is a financial supporter of NPR. Today's the deadline for a handful of universities. They've been asked to agree to a list of commitments aligning with the Trump administration's political priorities. That would be in exchange for preferential access to federal funding. NPR's Alyssa Nadworny reports.
The White House sent the so-called Compact for Academic Excellence in Higher Education to 9 colleges, both private and public, on October 1st. It would require schools to freeze tuition for 5 years, limit international student enrollment, and require standardized tests for admissions, among other things. The University of Virginia is among the schools to decline. UVA's interim president said they wanted, quote, no special treatment when it comes to federal funding.
On Friday, the White House held a meeting with college leaders to discuss the compact. On X, Education Secretary Linda McMahon said the meeting was, quote, positive and an important step. The White House did not provide details on how they will incorporate feedback or make changes to the compact. Alyssa Nadworny, NPR News.
A new study in the journal Pediatrics finds that a medical recommendation to parents has helped thousands of children avoid common food allergies. The guidance was issued a decade ago. It asked parents to feed peanut products to children as early as 4 months old. The study says that since then, about 60,000 children have avoided developing peanut allergies. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Nearly 3 million New Yorkers are currently enrolled in SNAP, the federal food assistance program. On average, households receive about $90 a week to help pay for groceries. But because of recent federal law changes, many families could lose their SNAP benefits as soon as November, which is several months earlier than expected. Back in July, big changes to SNAP were included in President Donald Trump's so-called One Big Beautiful Bill, including expanded work requirements. They require recipients to continually prove they've worked, volunteered, or attended school for at least 20 hours a week. If recipients do not or don't submit the right paperwork, they're limited to receiving food assistance for just 3 months in a three-year period. Those changes were expected to hit New York next March when a waiver was set to expire, which exempts residents from work requirements. But a recent federal order will force the state to start enforcing work requirements in just a few weeks at the beginning of November. This will likely cut several hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers off from benefits. Joining us now is John Little, Commissioner of Health and Human Services for Sullivan County. His department oversees programs that touch nearly every household in the Sullivan Catskills, from child care to social services, public health, and nutrition support. If that federal funding isn't renewed, as many as 6,000 households here in Sullivan County could miss their November SNAP benefits. Commissioner Little, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Tim.
So with roughly 6,000 SNAP cases at risk in Sullivan County, if this federal funding doesn't get renewed, what would that mean for these families on the ground? How might their daily lives and food security be affected?
Yeah, it's very concerning for us, Tim, because we're already seeing high utilization of food pantries. Our local school districts have built food pantries and backpack programs to help kids out. We are fortunate in Sullivan County that we have some really outstanding programs like, the community covert that operates out of Cornell Cooperative, with the folks from, Sullivan Allies Lean Together. We also have a Single Bite. So there's some very good programs out there to help out, but they can only do so much. And, you know, as you rightly point out, there's, as of last month, 6,400 households across the county. That amounts to total number of folks we're looking at in Sullivan County is about 12,500, 4,700 of those recipients are children. And that's just the concern we have for the program writ large, because there will be no payments come November 1st as far as we've been told from the state and federal level so far. You also mentioned the passage of changes to the SNAP program via the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which is impacting able-bodied adults without dependents. We were expecting that the waiver for that program to be able to continue to expire in February and pick that up in March, but we did get the notification from the feds that we'll be starting earlier. So that's putting a lot of stress on my staff as well, as they try and get notices out to the 500 folks that impacts. And so it's a lot. There's a lot of churn in the SNAP program right now, and a lot of concerns that folks have, very rightly going forward. And so we're just trying to stay on top of the changes as best we can.
How is this? Well, there's two things here, right? The shutdown, and then we've got this rather surprising order that speeds up the work requirements. How is this going to be impacting, you know, local food services, food pantries, food partners that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation?
Yeah, unfortunately, I fully expect that there's going to be even more demand headed towards the food pantries, and you know, that's sad. Levels. It's sad that, you know, that's what our community, you know, needs to rely on and is leaning on. It's also sad for the food pantries because, the food pantries have been, reliant for a long time on local food, provided by farmers, that comes through the Hudson Valley Food Bank. And a lot of the money via the Farm Bill, other federal legislation that has enabled those farmers to sell their products into that system, that was taken away earlier this year. So we have people are going to be relying on food banks more, and there's going to be less nutritious food available at the food banks as this all continues to develop. So it's really a dangerous situation that we're starting to head into here.
How is your department coordinating with those partners to handle this potential surge?
Well, we certainly talk. I mean, I have a coordination meeting with all of our local community-based organizations every Thursday afternoon. We get together, share information on, you know, what we're seeing on the ground, what we think might be changing, and you know, it's really trying to stay in communication. Fortunately, we also have, you know, a really tight network at this point. Like I said, we get together every week. And we're backed by technology tools that the county has invested in via the Unite Us referral system. We have great local partners like Sullivan 180 and their community resource guide that help people find the different food pantry resources that are out there. So we certainly encourage folks to go to Sullivan180.org and get the community resource guides so that they know where they can access nutrition around the county. And it's really just at this moment staying connected so that we can keep as many people who are entitled to these benefits to keep them on the program, because one additional aspect of all this is recertifications are going to become more frequent, which is going to be difficult for us to maintain as well at the Department of Social Services. So it's really making sure that communications are up and everybody is working together so that we minimize the number of folks that are going to fall through the cracks.
Are you hearing from families who are SNAP recipients or people who receive SNAP, and what advice are you giving them right now?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of concern out there, and again, it's making sure folks stay connected, that they see, you know, we're putting out notices to folks as to when we might need them to come in to recertify, to provide additional documentation for the new federal requirements. So really, you know, paying attention, checking the mail, and keeping in touch with us is really important right now. Checking, you know, we'll continue to put out information through the Director of Communications for the county, Dan Hoos, via Facebook and on the radio and such. It's really about, you know, communicating and staying informed right now, because that is kind of where these programs are at. Is they have there is a lot of churn that's been created at the federal level. And so we just need folks to stay engaged with us, and we will help them through this difficult moment as best as we can.
Beyond the folks directly affected, are there going to be ripple effects across Sullivan County's economy or even the regional economy? You mentioned the Hudson Valley Food Bank, and you know, there are small businesses and community services.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little bit beyond my expertise. I'm not an economist, but certainly when you are pulling away the safety net, and we've certainly seen this in the changes to the child care system across the state. That on the one hand, when the governor expanded access to child care and added a lot of opportunities to participate in that program, added money to that program. We saw labor force participation tick up, and we saw, you know, new businesses open up. And so when you take those, safety net, pulls away, then you don't have as strong of a safety net, and labor force participation, we do believe is decreasing because, because the program got kind of too big for itself in the case of childcare. But certainly, you know, when folks can't put food on the table, that's going to impact, you know, how much they're willing or able to put into their rent. And then, you know, we already have a lot of challenges with housing across the state as it is. So there are definitely a lot of broader economic concerns and ripple effects that will come from this.
Some officials from other New York counties say they're worried about having enough staffing to process and verify this work requirement. Some departments across the state are reporting that they're already understaffed. You mentioned your staff and the burden it's putting on you. How are you guys handling this now?
So there's some good news there in that we're pretty close to being fully staffed as an agency. So we're fortunate in that regard. But on the flip side, the concerns that my colleagues have raised are totally valid, and we share them as well, because you know we are making folks recertify for these programs essentially twice as often as we used to before the Big Beautiful Bill was passed. So Medicaid, SNAP recertifications, that's more paperwork demand on us, and you know, we are looking at technology tools, using chatbots and things like that to hopefully expedite processing for folks. But that's all kind of coming, let's just say, not fast enough for the changes that have been introduced into the system. So while I'm not panicked about our staffing, there are definitely things we need to look at to be able to keep up with the increasing administrative burden on the staff and on our clients.
It looks like the shutdown is continuing with no real end in sight. November is next week. Is there anything that listeners can do to help in this time?
Yeah, I mean, I think I said last time I was on the air that, you know, supporting your local food bank, if you're fortunate enough in your family to be able to contribute to those organizations. And you know, fortunately, we have a lot of pantries available around the county. A lot of times they're run in local churches. So I would certainly encourage folks to engage that way. You know, just helping people stay informed on what is actually happening. Unfortunately, I think there's a lot of misinformation that tends to work its way out of social media and things like that. So staying in touch with, you know, real official government resources in the state of New York, County of Sullivan, I think would be very helpful for folks going forward. So that's what I would encourage folks to do right now.
John Little, a real Sullivan County official. Thank you for joining us this morning with an update. John Little's Commissioner of Health and Human Services for Sullivan County. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks, Tim.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, the Route 17 expansion is on pause. And Catskill Mountain Keeper says this could be a first step toward victory. The state is reassessing the project after community pushback. We'll have the details after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Coming up on WCNY's The Capitol Press Room, we'll get to know the Republican candidate running in a special election for the Assembly up in the North Country. All that and much more, wherever you download, stream, or tune in, WCNY's The Capitol Press Room. This afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, keeping New York voters connected this election season. Early voting in New York State begins October 25th and ends November 2nd. In Sullivan County, a polling place will be open in both Monticello and Liberty every day during early voting. Find your New York early voting polling place at elections.ny.gov. That's elections.ny.gov. Election Day is November 4th. This is Radio Catskill, keeping you connected this election season.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The New York State Department of Transportation has hit pause on its $1.4 billion plans to expand Route 17 from exits 113 in Wurtsboro to exit 131 in Monroe after significant community pushback. So what does this mean for the future of the highway? The Rethink Route 17 Alliance is the coalition pushing the state to invest in more accessible and environmentally sustainable transit alternatives, not more highway lanes. Radio Catskill's Kimberly Izar spoke with Taylor Jaffe, program manager at Catskill Mountain Keeper, about what the delay means and how residents can get involved.
Let's start with New York State Department of Transportation's initial plans. They were planning to invest this $1.4 billion to upgrade Route 17 through the Catskills. They said that it was necessary to enhance safety and reduce crashes, amongst other reasons. Not everyone is happy about this project. Let's start with why community members are pushing back.
Yeah. So community members are pushing back because we do see the need for increased safety along Route 17. We see the need for upgrades and, you know, there are potholes that need to be fixed. There are certainly intersections and exits that should meet current safety standards. But in order to have the conversion from Route 17 to Interstate 86 and to get that designation, there doesn't need to be a third lane added to the highway. And that is really where the community is not aligned with the department's, definition of safety. Mm-hmm. And that's really where we're pushing back.
And I know Catskill Moundkeeper has been really leading the charge with the Rethink Route 17 Alliance. Can you tell me a little bit more about this coalition and kind of how it came together?
Yeah, of course. So this coalition really came together because folks, you know, I think a lot of folks initially thought that this was a done deal. We're seeing through this pause that it is not, right? We have an opportunity to push back, to make our voices heard, and to have infrastructure that is beneficial to our communities and has community-centered solutions. And so it made sense for us to get together with like-minded folks who, you know, wanted to see these benefits in our communities rather than a highway just kind of like pave over our communities. And so that's really where folks got together. Both, we've got other environmental organizations. That's really the lens that we looked at it primarily because that is our, you know, background. Mountain Keeper is an environmental advocacy organization. And so we were initially really concerned with the climate impacts of this project. We are still concerned with the climate impacts from adding a third lane and inducing demand and creating air pollution and greenhouse gas emissions. But we are also really concerned with, you know, this is a huge investment and we want it to work for our communities and help create safer streets, both a safer Route 17 and safer streets in our towns and villages and cities, and facilitate the increased mobility of people, not just along that corridor, but also between our towns and to our main streets and really boost the region's economic vitality that way in a more comprehensive way.
Well, I know the Rethink Route 17 Alliance has been working with community members to reimagine other alternatives, right? As you talked about, to improve public transportation and also keep our residents safe here in our region. I'd love to just hear more about some of the ideas and alternatives that folks have kind of come up with and why those feel maybe potentially more urgent or more productive than expanding the highway.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know if you'll hear the rustling, but I literally just pulled out our our report for folks who haven't seen it yet. This is called Invest in Our Communities, Not a Wider Highway. And you can find this at www.rethinkroute17.org. But for us, some of the more pressing needs and where we would want to see this money spent is around priorities that to us really speak to safety and also really speak to giving residents increased choice for more affordable and accessible transportation. So one I want to highlight is, for $600,000, we could fund the Orange County Roadway Safety Action Plan. And this prioritizes approaches to achieving zero fatalities on Orange County roadways and funds safety measures. So that is like specifically a safety project. Vision Zero, I think, is a really important aspect that is missing from this overall picture. And we want to see that included. So that's one that I wanted to call out for safety. And then for, you know, increased mobility, this is in Sullivan County. So, you know, more near and dear to my heart as a Livingston Manor resident, but there is one for Orange County as well. But for And let me find this one. For $5 million, we could double the number of bus routes in Sullivan County. And the impact is that this could provide hundreds of thousands of rides each year. So that means that folks who don't have access to a car, whether it's young folks or older folks, low-income people, people with disabilities, you name it. And or even just like me, who, you know, my car's in the shop for whatever reason.
Right.
That is a really tangible difference in our quality of life if more people are able to use the bus when they need it. And then in Orange County, that looks like for $20 million, we could significantly upgrade the intercity bus service in Orange County. So right now, for example, if you lived in Newburgh and wanted to get to Goshen, which is the county seat and where the county legislature meets to make decisions, you would have to take three different bus connections to make it all the way from Newburgh to Goshen. Meanwhile, it's really not a far drive. So both in Sullivan and Orange counties, there's real opportunity and real need to increase bus service as kind of like the primary way to help folks get around who don't have access to a car.
Yeah. And I was just, there was an article that came out from one of our news partners, New York Focus, about how they ran the numbers and they estimated that if the highway was actually expanded, it would really only save drivers 5 or 6 minutes or so. I want to touch base briefly on their most recent announcement. So earlier this month, the New York State Department of Transportation announced the state would hit pause on the Route 17 highway expansion. And this came after significant, you know, community input and pushback. What does the pause mean to you exactly?
The pause to us means that, one, we hear that pause as, you know, the Department of Transportation and Governor Hochul really hearing this community pushback and, you know, wanting to actually take the time to reassess these alternatives to see if, you know, we can come together and create a more community-centered solution. That's the primary thing we're hearing from this pause and you know, really want to give the thanks and kudos where it's due for that. With this pause, we also see a real opportunity to go back to the drawing board altogether, right? And this, the idea of that is not to say that, you know, we want to delay these very needed safety upgrades, right? Certainly there are safety concerns on Route 17, and we want those to be addressed as soon as possible. We want to see the expansion taken out of the project alternatives, and we'd really like to see these safety measures added in addition to other investments throughout the region that have more of a regional focus to improve the quality of life for residents across the region, instead of having that third lane. The idea of the third lane is that, you know, it'll improve the flow of traffic, but, you know, induced demand has shown, the science is overwhelming, that when you add a new lane, more people will come to drive on it. And that having people come to drive through our region, creating air pollution, noise pollution, those greenhouse gas emissions, directly in our communities, driving through our communities instead of coming to be within them, you know, that is not the economic development that we want to see. And so we, with this pause, really want to take the opportunity to have these conversations with Governor Hochul, with Commissioner Dominguez and the Department of Transportation to figure out how we can meet these interstate standards and get this interstate designation. Really upgrade Route 17 so that is it is a safe highway. And, you know, with whatever funding has already, you know, been approved for Route 17 and for this region, how can we spend that to really increase residents' quality of life and increase transportation outcomes, right? So instead of saving 1 to 6 minutes on a wider Route 17, which over time will disappear and in fact reverse as there is more demand, you know, how can we actually help folks to, maybe if they don't want to have a car, not have their car on the road, or maybe you do have a car, but you're not always driving on Route 17 and the back roads that you take are really suffering. So how can we shift the focus from a third lane to other much higher priorities across the region?
And does the Rethink Route 17 Alliance have any plans in the next few months to connect with lawmakers about kind of this reimagining that we're talking about?
Yes, we are really hoping, as I mentioned, to connect with Governor Hochul and Commissioner Dominguez. There is not something scheduled yet, as I'm saying this, but we're really hoping to be able to have that conversation. We are also going to talk to all of our decision makers. So reaching out to both, you know, like town supervisors, town boards along the corridor and within the region, and also to our assembly members and senators in the New York State Legislature to really go back to folks, point to this pause and say, hey, this really isn't a done deal. What are your priorities for the region? Here are our community's priorities. How do they align with the priorities you see in your district? And how can we work together to meet those priorities so that folks can get around better and safer?
Well, Taylor, before we sign off, do you want to just share with folks how they can learn more about the Rethink Route 17 campaign and how people can stay plugged in and get involved?
Yeah, so please go check out www.rethinkroute1717.org. There you'll be able to find more information on the Alliance, our vision for the region. You'll be able to find our report, Invest in Our Communities, Not a Wider Highway. And there is even a tab where you can take action and contact us. So please join our mailing list. And we've got a petition going around right now to remove the expansion, that third lane, from the project alternatives on this Route 17 project. So thanks all for listening, and I hope we are able to connect with you that way.
I've been chatting with Taylor Jaffe from the Catskill Mountain Keeper. You can stay updated on their efforts on their website, as Taylor mentioned. That's at rethinkroute1717.org. Again, rethinkroute17.org. Taylor, thank you so much for chatting today.
Thank you, Kim. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Thanks to Kim for that. And we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll check in with James B. Huntington, local economist and author, for Local Economic Perspective. This is Radio Chatskill.
Hey there, I'm Kimberly Izar, saying thanks again for helping us reach our fund drive goal and to invite you to Pints for Public Radio on Sunday afternoon. Help the Radio Catskill crew celebrate with an afternoon of brews, beats, and community spirit. Drink beer, support public radio, it's that simple. So join me for a pint for independent local media. Pints for Public Radio, noon to 4 on Sunday at Wall and Pawpack Brewing Company in Holly, Pennsylvania. I'll see you there.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and it's Monday. Time to check in with James B. Huntington, local author and economist, for some local economic perspective. James B., good morning.
Good morning, Tim. Good morning, listeners.
Well, let's jump into a recent poll that's showing the most important issue facing the country, even above the economy. What's that issue?
Well, it isn't actually even the economy. It is the economy. Economy and jobs were number one in this CBS News poll that came out recently, 27%. That's not a majority anywhere near, but it was higher than anything else. 21% said inflation, 15% said health care, 14% immigration, 9% crime, 9% government spending, and 4% events overseas, various and sundry. So this is important here. Jobs and the economy seem to be number one as far as what Americans are concerned about.
And many Americans still worry about finding good jobs despite some low unemployment. What sectors are hiring right now? What jobs are in demand?
Well, there are a couple of them that are looking a lot better than the job market in general. They are health care and social assistance and leisure and hospitality. The health care and social assistance, many of the jobs are health care services for ambulatory people, such as outpatients, also hospitals, nursing and residential care, Social assistance covers individual and family services, community food and housing, emergency and other relief services, vocational rehabilitation, and child care services. Those are areas, if you think about it, that just have demand all the time. They're not going to be pulled down too much by economic problems. So think about those. If your skills might work in one of those positions, you might be pleasantly surprised by the opportunities available.
And AI is changing workplaces fast. How should students deal with a work world where AI is almost a part of every job?
Well, this is quite a large thing. This came out in USA Today. This said, first of all, to realize that AI is here. It's not some future fantasy. It's transforming a lot of jobs, has a lot to go. It's not the enemy, but it isn't magic either. So stay away from shortcuts and the temptation to cheat. What employers are looking for is not only people who use AI, they want people who can manage it, who can take care of it, who can minimize some things. So it can be important to rethink your career paths. The 4 points they make here to go for new job opportunities for people who are entering the job market are, first, embrace AI, but stay grounded. Second, keep learning. AI will keep evolving, and so you're going to need to keep learning as time goes on, as things change pretty much all the time. 3, protect your ethics. Just because tech can help you cut corners doesn't mean you should. Think about it. And 4, be flexible. The path may twist and turn, and that's okay.
Well, AI is here, as you said. That means some AI-driven scams are here, too, and they're on the rise, like phishing and deepfakes. What are some warning signs for folks to spot these scams?
Well, small red flags are mentioned in this piece here, which was by the technical expert Kurt Knutson in Fox News. There are things you see, first of all, suspicious senders' addresses that doesn't match the company's domain. Generic greetings such as dear customer instead of your name. Urgent requests. Excessive urgency is often fishy, pun intended, when there are phishing scams, because often it's not really necessary. If you think about job offers and such or job opportunities, no one's saying you need to respond right now. It just doesn't work that way, and legitimate people know that. Also, you can analyze the language for AI-generated patterns. You get business emails, but you can still sort of sense that it's a phishing thing if you look at the language of the body. It often looks highly formal with a few failed attempts to be personal. It's a hard thing to describe, but if you see that it looks sort of overly formal, then it may be an AI-generated thing that isn't for real. Also, look for AI voice clone scam warning signs. There are people calling who sound like people you know, but it's not quite there. It's just a little bit short of what they might be. If you look at visual glitches and oddities in video calls, sometimes there are some strange thing. You were talking about deepfakes. Well, they're getting more and more convincing, but they're not flawless. They still have bugs. They have visual inconsistencies and oddities, maybe or maybe not, the day when somebody is you're looking at in Zoom or something equivalent might have a third arm or something. Those things might be gone, but there still are things that don't make quite much sense. Second, the idea of setting up and using a shared secret, some kind of password or something that you have between you and somebody else, maybe something if it's a parent, you can be something you did as a child, which doesn't have any connection to what you're doing now, would be a good one. Things that are not going to turn up anywhere. And so what you need to do is stay cautious with unsolicited messages, use a data removal service. Yeah, put in the two-factor authentication. Do it twice. I know it's a nuisance, but it's still often necessary to do that. And otherwise, verify requests through another channel. If your mother's talking with you and it's just not quite right, if she calls you with some emergency, then ask if you can call her back on another phone number or something, or send her an email, or use another way of doing that. The whole thing may collapse like the house of cards it is if you can do that.
Now, ChatGPT is one of the chatbots developed by OpenAI that generates these human-like responses. And now what are they offering and allowing for folks who are verified or verified adults?
Yes, well, they are finally breaking their proscription against erotica.
Oh, dear.
So people can put things together that are erotic if they are verified adults. It's going to be happening, so you won't get that unless you ask for it, it says. But a couple things are significant here. Number one, you may have deep fakes or actually pretty shallow fakes with people. You know, they may be turning up more often in bogus pictures of them and such things. And the other thing is that it will allow, shall we say, hobbyists to put this sort of material together to their tastes. You will be able to use it. But watch out for things that are, you think are right next to or over the legal line, because those can still get you in trouble. And really, it's mainly designed for something you would keep to yourself. So if you do that, then you won't be damaging anyone else, and there shouldn't be any problems associated with that.
All right, let's move on. Let's talk about the numbers. Let's talk about where things are this morning and for the last couple of weeks, because we had a holiday last week.
Yes, these are two-week changes. We have gold, $42.55, up $313.
Wow.
It's just getting more and more stunning. I mean, and I'm reading things about people selling gold, for gold scrap and gold jewelry and such things, just pouring into the places that are buying it, because these rates are way up there. Silver, $51.85. That's up $3.22. The ratio is 82 to 1. It's slightly higher, but we did have 77 to 1 in the past week because silver went up the last 2 weeks, rather, because silver went up and sooner than gold did, so it was really quite high. Dow Jones Industrial Average, 46,191. That's down 567. Pretty much gave up last week's gain. We had a minus 900 day in the last 2 weeks. We didn't quite recover from that, but we are getting a lot of volatility and fluctuation. NASDAQ, 22,680. That's down an even 100. A small loss, did better than the Dow. Oil, West Texas Intermediate, 57.14, down almost $5. Wow, business problems mean our gains. So let's expect that we will have cheaper and cheaper gas, because the price of oil, I don't know, that's a, off the top of my head, that might be a three-year low, something like that, or more than that. It's really, really low. Bitcoin, 111,208. That's down 12,666. More than gave back what it gained. It does fluctuate a lot. British pound, 1.3416, down 1/6 of a cent. A slight loss, no big deal there, and even less of a deal for the euro, which is 1.1662, or down 0.03 of a cent, really not doing anything. And the Japanese 100-yen coin stayed once again at 66 cents, hanging out at a lower rate now. So overall, we just have turbulence, turbulence, and turbulence, but the metals are heading the list, and platinum and palladium, which I don't track on this show, are also up about 50%, from what they were earlier this year. Platinum 1600, palladium's 1447. They're also, so any of these four precious metals are still doing extremely well.
All right, James B. Huntington, local author and economist, keeping us steady as the turbulence continues. James B., thanks so much.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, listeners.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, culture reporter Valerie Manzi visits Bushel Collective in Delhi. This is Radio Chatskill.
This is Kusar Grace KG, right here in the place to be, WJFF Radio Catskill Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9. 2 hours of great music, jazz, funk, blues. I got mellow grooves to help you unwind, exciting rhythms to help you cut loose. Join me Tuesday night for the Music Emporium, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
You're with Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. At the Bushel Collective in Delhi, New York, a new exhibit called Symbiocene Era, Mycelium, Soils, and Roots invites visitors to explore the deep connections between art, ecology, and community, featuring works made from botanical pigments, soil, and fungi, plus soundscapes, workshops, and forest walks. The show celebrates the living networks that sustain us. Culture reporter Valerie Manzi spoke with artist and curator Kathleen Sweeney about how the exhibit came to life.
Welcome back, Kathleen. I'm happy to have you here again at WJFF on Radio Chatskill.
Thank you for inviting me, Valerie. Very nice to talk to you again.
Yes, you're a busy, busy woman, a busy echo artist. And you have a big event coming up Saturday, October 25th.
Yes, I'm curating a show called The Symbiocene Era, Mycelium, Soils, and Roots, featuring the work of 14 eco-artists who are exploring different ways of collaborating with nature and moving beyond any kind of toxins in their work. So it's a really interesting exploration. And that's opening October 25th, 4 to 7 p.m. at Bushel Collective in Delhi, New York. That's 106 Main Street in Delhi.
And it'll be up through December, correct?
Yes, the show will run through December 7th, 2025.
And for those of us that might not be familiar with Symbiocene and Anthropocene, can you give us some brief information about their origins and meaning?
Yeah, so the Anthropocene era is basically tied to the industrial era. So it's basically from the time of the turn of the last century and also the activation of fossil fuels as a key heating and machine-driven source. So basically the extraction industries, mining and extraction of fossil fuels, and how that sort of permeated our lives for many decades now, to the point where many people feel a little bit beset that humans would be perceived, or Homo sapiens be perceived, as kind of like the destroyers of the planet. And one of the things proposed by using the term Symbiocene is to kind of soften that perspective, which links to the doom and gloom about climate change, and begin to perceive ourselves as collaborators in symbiosis with the planet, in symbiosis with other life forms on the planet, wildlife, plants, mushrooms, fungi, and all kinds of other interactive beings who exist, coexist on the planet with us. And so this idea extends into the idea of into how we create. So many artists use acrylics, for example, and acrylics are actually plastic. And the more that we're learning about acrylics and microplastics entering into the water systems, this idea of using an art material that ends up poisoning us and the water systems is just not a great idea. So there's a bunch of artists who are now beginning to look into grinding their own mineral pigments, rediscovering, say, Renaissance-era techniques or even earlier for using indigo, using plant dyes, using these to make their own watercolors. There are people who are collaborating with molds and fungi to actually create paintings on silk. So these are all kind of really interesting, kind of out there ideas, but they are moving into the vernacular in a way that actually is a comfort to me. And so I wanted to highlight and showcase these artists' work.
That sounds like there's quite a bit of labor involved.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very different thing to go to an art supply store and buy a tube of something that you squeeze out and then dip your paintbrush in it and start to make it. No, there's more of a connection between you and the manifestation of the art materials themselves. It also means that once these little secret recipes are and the alchemy of them is rediscovered, you actually can have art materials right at your fingertips in the woods. Or some people are using things like post-industrial materials like rust, different types of metals, copper. These all create pigments that people are starting to explore as well.
And do they come under the rubric of eco artists?
That's a kind of umbrella term that probably dates back to the 70s, but anyone who is basically environmentally conscious about the work and the impact that their art making is having on the planet pretty much falls under that umbrella.
And it's interesting, there have been a number of exhibits and talks by artists about the environment, and it hasn't always really touched on the materials they use.
It's an interesting thing, because I've met people who are environmentalists who really care about the planet, and some of them are using acrylics, but not thinking about what happens when they wash their brushes. You know, it's very recent that we're starting to understand that plastics aren't truly being recycled, and the impact of plastics on our waterways at the micro level. I don't think we understood that. So it's kind of like the idea behind the show is to also initiate dialogues and conversations to bring awareness to some of these issues through the lens of art making and creativity.
Are any of your artists familiar with the organization Beyond Plastics?
Well, yes, actually, I took a workshop with Beyond Plastics to learn much more deeply about the pernicious aspects to our plastic culture. So as curator, yes, I have a kind of training that I took with the founder, Judith Enck. She offers an online workshop to learn all about the origins of plastics and the mythologies around recycling and how that extends into creative approaches to bringing forward awareness, public awareness about plastics. So I also encountered a number of artists who are not in this show who are doing things like bringing huge costumes that they make out of plastics that they've collected and making a statement as a giant, obese enterprise made of plastic, things like that. There's another woman who has a coffin that's made of, filled with plastic, and she calls her piece Death by Plastic. So none of the artists that are currently in the show took the training, but we've all been kind of dialoguing about these things together.
Can you focus a little on a couple of the artists?
It's considered pretty much a multimedia show. So we have photographers who are interested in really bringing awareness to the kinship with nature. There's one artist who's a well-known furniture maker from the city who moved his studio upstate. And he uses extracted coal to polish into these very unique sculptures. So, and his philosophy is that he's using extracted coal that's never going to be burned. It's going to turn into an art object. He also makes these polished coal tables. And they're really quite extraordinary to see the fissures in the surface of this material. It's not quite stone. It's a lot more fragile than that. But to also think in new ways about how can we utilize some of these materials that have already been taken out of the earth and not turn them into polluting elements for the air or the water. So that's one artist. And then we have Emily Johnston is an artist who lives in the Catskills, and she's dedicated to creating her own watercolors using mineral pigments just derived from the Catskills. And she goes out on these walks and finds different colored stones in a stream near her house, and she takes them back and grinds them into pigments and then uses them to create one-of-a-kind watercolors on linen. So she's somebody also who's really focused on the Catskills, the rainbow palette of the Catskills specifically. And it's very beautiful to go to her studio and watch her pull open her drawers filled with petri dishes that have all different colors of stones that are derived from our own environment here in the Catskills.
Wow, my hat's off to her.
And then another artist, Mina Teslaru, uses upcycled cotton and linen fabrics and then dyes them with different levels of indigo. So she's created basically like a gradation palette of indigo. And then this piece that she has in the show is called the Seeds Project. And she has basically embroidered images of seeds and root systems and growth over the indigo dyed fabrics. And they're very beautiful. Mary McFerrin is an artist who has also used upcycling, and she's basically delved into the history of female farmers in the Catskills, women who ran their own farms in the 1800s, and read their diaries and integrated elements of those diaries into embroidered cloth. And she also used all plant-based dyes to create spectrums of color across these pages of a book that she put together that's made of cloth. I mean, I could go on and on. Each one is very interesting. There's going to be also a soundscape collaboration with a synthesizer and mushrooms. So there's a woman named Roberta Trenton. She's going to be doing a live experience with this synthesizer that is connected with nodes to the mushrooms themselves. Scientists are now discovering that all living plants and mushrooms give off sound waves. We just can't hear them.
Yes.
Unless there's a translator of some kind. So it's more like a kind of Brian Eno-esque kind of sound system, so very experimental, but it's really fascinating that we're capturing now these audio signals that are coming from these beings that we didn't really acknowledge very much before.
Well, this is very exciting to hear about, and it sounds even more exciting to see and listen to. And that will be in Delhi at the Bushell Collective, and that's B-U-S-H-E-L collective.org for more information.
Could I just also mention that we're going to be offering 3 workshops over the course of the events?
Absolutely.
So Sunday, October 26th, Jenna Spevak, another artist who's doing a place-based experience of walking on her land called the Vertical Path. And she basically takes people through the crown to the roots of trees in, metaphorically, and takes people on a guided walk. So that's happening Sunday, October 26th from 12 to 2 p.m. And you register at Bushell, and then you will receive the address. Saturday, November 8th, Emily Johnson, who I mentioned before, is offering an earth pigments workshop at her studio in Bovina, and that's 10 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. Saturday, November 8th. And then Saturday, November 15th from 2 to 4 p.m., Gabriella D'Elia, who's one of the partners in Catskill Fungi, is offering a deep imagination mushroom circle. So she's going to take people through writing prompts and creative visualizations about our relationship to mushrooms and the fungal kingdom. Or queendom.
Or queendom. Okay, well,
yeah.
Thank you again, Kathleen, for engaging in this project and sharing all of this information with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I look forward to meeting you in person.
And thanks to Valerie. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Dog Mountain Lodge, providing dog boarding and grooming, also boarding cats, birds, and other exotic pets. Located in Coshecton, New York, and on the web at dogmountainlodge.com. And from North American Cultural Laboratory, Highland Lake, New York, an experimental workspace for performing artists and inquisitive audiences, creating a space for community celebration throughout the year, nacl.org. And from listeners like you.
Political polarization pushes people apart, but writer Chloe Valdery says we can close those divisions by allowing for one simple thing, the possibility that we can still be enchanted by the people around us.
When you remember this about your neighbor and you act accordingly, there will be less unnecessary suffering and less unnecessary pain in the world.
That's on the next On Point.
Monday morning at 11 on Radio Catskill.
And that's coming right up. A check of the weather first. Windy and cooler with rain today. 55 for a high. breezy early tonight, otherwise partly cloudy overnight, low 39. Tomorrow, we've got some sun mixing in with the clouds, a high near 60. And cooler on Wednesday, a high 51. Even cooler Thursday, breezy, a high 48. It's 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.